Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday morning, August the 14th. This hour, we talk with the author of the new book, The Myth of the Rational Voter, Why Democracies Choose Bad Policies. He's an economist, Brian Kaplan, and he says that the greatest obstacle to sound economic policy is not special interests or lobbying, but the misconceptions, the irrational beliefs, and the personal biases held by ordinary voters and the politicians who cater to them. We will welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Do you consider yourself a rational voter? Do you think most voters are too ignorant when it comes to, say, economic policies to really know what's good for them? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Brian Kaplan is an associate professor of economics at George Mason University. He is author of The Myth of the Rational Voter, Why Democracies Choose Bad Policies. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Are you saying that voters are stupid?
No, I'm not saying the voters are stupid. I'm saying that they generally don't apply themselves nearly as hard to political affairs as they would to their own lives. So there's a lot of issues where, for example, when someone's shopping, it doesn't take a college degree to think very critically and thoughtfully about what kinds of purchases you're making. But when people go to the voting booth or think about more abstract questions, they usually go with their gut feeling rather than thinking things through.
Yeah. Do we have to be economists to be able to vote properly?
You don't have to be economists, but it would help if people were to learn at least some of the basic lessons of economics, just the kinds of things that are taught in Economics 101, which are really pretty counterintuitive to most people, and not only counterintuitive, but in fact often anger people. But nevertheless, they are some. They are very well established.
Mm. Yeah, they do anger. On one hand, it's this, and on the other hand, it's that.
Right. That's one of the misconceptions for which I blame other economists. It isn't that is the there is a very solid core that has an extremely wide range of agreement. You can see everyone from very liberal democratic economists to very conservative Republican economists to very libertarian economists converging on a common list of basic economic truths. But unfortunately, when we get on TV, we tend to argue with each other, or probably that's because you don't get on TV unless you're willing to argue. It's rare that you get two economists on TV who say, all right, now here's the list of things that we agree on. And yet there is a pretty strong list that economists do agree on. Just for example, there's the question of international trade. Almost everyone who can explain the basic arguments for and against free trade does think the free trade is the better policy, regardless of their political background. And yet this is the kind of thing that you would generally miss if you were just look at what economists are saying on TV, where you get the feeling that it is on the one hand, on the other hand. Not so.
Yeah. Let's talk about these. I think you have about four basic assumptions you think that there that most of us have misconceptions about, and one of them is free trade. I mean, the free trade is we hear lots of debate going on right now that now all these jobs, the manufacturing jobs, are all going overseas, and we're worse off for it.
Right. Actually, it's a little bit more general than that. I call that anti-foreign bias. Basically, any time that foreigners enter the economic picture, people tend to lose their cool. So, but in general, in cases where you have two Americans trading with each other, at least up to a point, people say, well, yeah, I guess that if two Americans trade with each other, both are going to be better off as a result. But make that one American and one Chinese who are trading with each other, and then people start thinking the Chinese are going to be taking advantage of us somehow or ripping us off or doing something strange to us so that, well, it might appear that both sides are better off. Actually, the Chinese are gaining. Of course, meanwhile, over in China, they have the same but reversed perception that the Americans are ripping them off. It's kind of interesting that you'll see that people on both sides think that the other country must somehow have some nefarious plans for them.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, so that was the distrust of foreigners example that I used with our jobs going overseas?
Some jobs are going overseas, some overseas jobs are coming over here. In general, cutting your country off from the world economy is not a good way to increase employment. It is a good way to impoverish yourself, however.
Yeah, and you also think that that we, too many of us, believe that the economy is going from bad to worse?
Yeah, that's right. So, of course, there's recent economic news of a downturn. I'm talking about general long-term trends. So, whereas non-economists generally lean in the direction of thinking that the economy is going from bad to worse, on the other hand, economists will say, well, if you look at the long-term numbers, things are really a lot better than you think. In fact, things have gotten a lot better in the last 20 years, and there's every reason to think that things are going to continue to get better, but somehow in their guts, people just feel like doom is coming, even when it's hard to actually put your finger on why.
And we don't trust the free market system?
Right. So this is something that I call anti-market bias. And again, it's important to understand that this is something where there's a broad level of agreement so that you can go and talk to liberal democratic economists and you'll get a much more favorable view of how markets work than you will talking to just a typical moderate non-economist. So, I mean, just to take an example at random, it's very hard to find a non-economist who thinks it's a good idea to have a free market in kidney sales for human organ donation. But on the other hand, it's very hard to find an economist who thinks that it's not a good idea. Because basically right now we've got a lot of people who need kidneys. And first of all, we have a lot of perfectly good kidneys that just get buried because people don't sign their organ donation cards, which again, if they were offered some money to do so, they would probably change their minds. But on top of that, it's also quite possible for a person to live a full healthy life with one kidney, but people are not about to start handing over their kidneys to strangers for free. If you could pay them an amount of money, which compared to the value of a life is pretty small, if you could pay someone $10,000 to save your life, that would be a very good deal, and that would probably be enough to get a very large number of kidneys to be sold by people who right now obviously are not going to hand them out for free.
Yeah. And you're saying that you and, say, Paul Krugman agree on these economic principles?
To a very surprising degree. I'd be a little more confident about the Paul Krugman of 10 years ago who was focusing more on economics. Now I'm a little bit less confident that at least we would agree as much. But basically, it is quite surprising. You can take a look at his book, The Accidental Theorist, where he spends a lot of time talking about unemployment in Europe. And Paul Krugman's explanation for what's wrong with employment in Europe is government regulation. Government in Europe has made it very, very costly for employers to hire new employees, very hard to fire, which means that if you are stuck with an employee for life, you're going to be very cautious about hiring in the first place. And in that book, Paul Krugman offers a ringing denunciation of government regulation as the cause of unemployment in Europe, one that, as a liberal democratic economist, he was still quite happy to make, and it's sound.
So if there's agreement on these basic economic principles, why do we, so many of us, according to you, hold all these misconceptions and vote irrationally?
Right. Well, that's a very interesting question. I would say a lot of it is that what economists are saying, while true, nevertheless rubs people the wrong way. So why exactly it does rub people the wrong way, it's not so easy to say, but for whatever reason, for example, when you say that both sides gain when we trade with China, people don't like that. They say, what do you mean? The Chinese are over there, and they're doing these things to us, and they're just out for themselves, and you think that we should trust them and trade with them? And the economist is saying, yeah, well, what exactly do you think they're going to do to you when you go and buy some toys from them? You're getting some cheap toys out of it. They're getting some income out of it. Again, people often think, well, there's some kind of national security concern when they hold a lot of our debt. Simple point to make is that if anyone ought to be worried, it is actually the Chinese, because if there were actually an international incident, they're the ones who are holding a lot of our debt, and we're the ones who've already gotten the stuff that we wanted. So,
well, I suppose we also think there's something wrong with that because we have stories in the news about tainted toys and everything else.
Right. Well, every now and then there's going to be a bad product sold, but clearly that hasn't been enough to convince people they actually shouldn't buy stuff from China, because events like that, while newsworthy, are extremely rare.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, though, if we are still... you're saying that we are, you know, we don't like these economic policies, mm-hmm. and we vote for people who, you know, maybe agree with us, mm-hmm. But we have these economic policies. So, I mean, what's the implication? We're not. I don't see how these the policies that you think are good exist.
Ah, well. Mm. I mean, what I would say is that, for example, on free trade, it's not true that we have free trade. We do not actually see off the border, but if you take a look at the regulations that we have, there's still some very substantial barriers to trade that exist. So say that in general, when you take a look at the policies that we have, there has been a lot of influence of these misconceptions. Now, you may say, and I think it's right, that it's surprising that there are not more restrictions on international trade. So part of what I do in the book is first go over public opinion and say, you know, here's what the public thinks. At this point, you say, wow, in this case, it is a little bit surprising that the policy is not a lot worse than it already is. There are a couple reasons why we probably tend to get better policy than we ask for. One of them is just that if politicians were actually to do what voters say they want, there would be some very bad consequences, and voters would get angry at the politicians who did exactly what they were asked for. So we would basically tend to make scapegoats of politicians who gave us precisely what we wanted. If a politician really were to build a wall around the country to keep out foreign products, there would be a very sharp decline in our standard of living, and people would be upset about it, even though they actually might have agreed with the policy of building the wall, but still the politician who did exactly what was asked of him would be blamed for the failure. So now on the surface, this might seem like a bad thing, but I'd say, you know, this is really a good thing. At least politicians have some incentive not to second-guess the public and think, is this really going to be such a good idea? Because if they do what the public wants and it blows up in their face, the politicians probably will be blamed for it anyway. So, you know, they think that's at least part of the reason why we get better policies than public opinion would make you think we would get.
We're talking with Brian Kaplan. He is an associate professor of economics at George Mason University and the author of The Myth of the Rational Voter, Why Democracies Choose Bad Policies. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up a little later this morning, Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock, and Kathleen will talk with a guest about Karl Rove stepping down as the White House Deputy Chief of Staff. That's coming up after 9. We're talking about whether you and I are irrational, and whether we maybe are too ignorant when it comes to certainly economic policies to make good voting choices. Do we, for example, favor policies that hurt the economy, that hurt our own pocketbook? Our guest says yes, and he says we go for politicians that will cater to those whims, and we welcome your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm wondering, Brian Kaplan, before we go to the phones, what are your proposed solutions to this problem?
Right. Well, the first and foremost one is just better education, better communication with the public, which is part of why I wrote the book and why I've been going on the radio and TV to talk about it. So I think, you know, one problem with economists is precisely this, on the one hand, on the other hand, thing that you were mm-hmm. talking about earlier. Economists generally don't like actually coming out and in 1 minute saying what roughly the correct answer is. They're very fond of qualification and mm-hmm. avoiding any definite statement. And part of what I'm doing in this book is saying, you know, we need to do a better job on this. If you have 1 minute to talk, you can't go and give an on the one hand, on the other hand message, because people won't take anything away. So a lot of what I do in the last chapter of the book is say, look, here are some things that we need to do in order to become better communicators. First thing is just to make a very clear point that people who have studied the subject for a long time think something very different from most people. It's easy to miss that point, but very important to make. Say, look, we think something different from what most people think. You know, step one, experts think something from what most people think. Step two, just give at least some idea about why it is that the experts have their contrarian view. And the third thing I say is just to try to make it fun. Don't be so boring. Try to entertain a bit more. Try to be a bit more flamboyant. I know that's not going to work for some economists, but I think that we can at least do a better job of entertaining. When I teach my classes, I try to not make it so dry, and I think it works at least better than it otherwise would.
Yeah. Saeed in Fond du Lac is with us first. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. Okay, my question to Professor Kaplan is, Professor Kaplan, you are on the line?
Yes.
My question is, say you are expecting too much from the voters, and the problem is the voters depend for their views or their opinions on experts. And my observation is they do not agree themselves. Experts do not agree themselves on so many issues, and voters turn to them, and they get confused, you know, what mm-hmm. position is the right position. Mm-hmm. And the second point is, voters are not given so many choices. I mean, they are given certain choices, and two or three given choices cannot be the best possible choices. There may be a fourth choice which might be the best choice, but none of the candidates is coming up with those choice, or with that choice number four. And that's the problem with the two-party system. I mean, it's a broader issue than we think.
Yeah, Saeed, thanks very much. A little bit of feedback on your phone line, so it's hard to understand exactly. But he's saying that we're hearing from experts who do not agree, but you're saying, Professor Kaplan, that the experts, especially with these economic policies, do agree.
Right. Yeah, I'm saying that actually experts do have a much broader area of agreement than you would think. So I can see how you might get the wrong impression from watching TV, and for that, economists are to blame. Although I would also say that very often when the public does hear what most economists think, there is a very angry reaction. So, you know, so it's not simply that the public will believe whatever it is that experts tell them. If experts were to say with one voice, free trade is a good idea, the public response would be, oh, yeah, well, that's just what guys like you would think because you don't understand the situation of the average American. And it is to this that that economists need to address themselves to realize that this is not something about, or this is not just about the policies that happen to personally benefit us. Actually, we have gone over the effects on the country as a whole, and we still think they're going to be positive. So economists especially have long faced this attitude that they're not really experts, or that they may know what they're talking about, but they're only giving one side of it to promote the policies that are in their own best interest. So, and it's kind of interesting that, for example, physicists don't face this kind of skepticism. So, I mean, part of what I want to do in the book is just to make more accessible the arguments that economists would use to explain their views so that it's easier to understand where economists are coming from.
Yeah. Thanks, Saeed. Tom in Watersmeet, Michigan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I really think it's a great idea to educate voters on issues, but politicians and economists spin the issue the way they want. So, for example, you're saying that free trade is this panacea, but sometimes we forget that there are greater costs. So, for example, the exotics that are coming into North America, and VHS is an example. It's a fish disease that came in from, I don't know, I think Europe or Southeast Asia. And so we are going to lose our tremendous fisheries that we had in North America, and we are going to end up with a fishery more like China with carp and some other things that managed to survive these diseases. And you can take a look at emerald ash borer, which isn't native. We're going to lose all of our ash trees. And we lose that economic component, the ecological component, the diversity in our forests. So I think that your spin is just like a politician's spin. You're saying free trade is this panacea, but there's a cost, and it's a cost not just today, but it's long term.
Okay. Let's see. Sure.
Yeah. Go ahead. Your response.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I certainly would never say that free trade is a panacea. The main claim that I make is that people underestimate the social benefits of free trade. It's possible there are some downsides. I'm not familiar with these particular infections that are being brought in from other countries, but certainly those are a downside. And the main thing that I would just say is that, even considering these other downsides, people do underestimate the gains they get from free trade.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom. Jason in Poplar Grove is with us now. Hi.
Hi. My question concerns game theory and economics. And from what I understand, right now as a computer programmer myself is that right now there's no good algorithms that are programmable to actually mimic the way that humans actually behave in economics, and of course that goes along with policy. And I was wondering if you could touch on any work that's been done with that or studies that you know of.
Do you know about that, Professor Kaplan?
I know a little bit about it. Let's see. Well, in terms of algorithms that can be used to understand quite what's going on, I'd say we have some general rules of understanding what it is that people do in certain in particular cases. In terms of actually narrowing it down to something extremely precise that we can get a great prediction about what any individual is going to do, there we are still quite far away, and may be far away for some time.
Thank you, Jason. Steve in Houston, Texas. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning to you. Good morning, Professor. This is a great show. You know, one of the things that concerns me, I'm a small business owner, and I don't have health insurance because it's so expensive. But and I'm really concerned that there's so little education about economic issues, consequences of economic policies, you know, with young people today. And I listened to the campaign, and I'm really, you know, Republicans have done a terrible job on a lot of issues in the last, since Bush took office. But I listened to, especially Barack Obama, I think he's probably a really good guy, but it really scares me because I've never heard anybody challenge him on the consequences. The Democrats, the consequences of some of the policies they're promoting. And I'm talking about the idea of government-financed welfare. Down here, we have a couple hundred thousand people from Louisiana that have come through us. An example of how government runs things, and this, I'll leave you with this, is I had a young man work for me who was here for a year, and the government paid for his apartment, they paid him welfare checks, and he wasn't even required for a year to go out and work. And this is how government runs things. And I'm really afraid that if any of the policies that Barack Obama and his Democrats, Hillary Clinton are promoting go forth, we're going to end up with a fiscal nightmare that's going to be monumental, even in comparison with what we're looking at with the Medicare and Medicaid debt that's going to come once these baby boomers start coming up, you know, coming into the system. And nobody's talking about it. And we're in for some real tough times in the next 20 years as a nation if we're going to survive economically, unless somebody challenges, you know, the Democrats, who are most likely going to win the White House next time, unless somebody challenges them on some of these policies. Because if they come to pass, how are we going to pay for it? Can you answer that for me?
Let's see. There's quite a lot going on there. Just at the outset, I would say that talking about us not economically surviving as a country is not very realistic. We're going to survive. Things are going to be at least fairly similar to how they are today. It does not mean that we aren't facing problems, but it's important to keep things in perspective. In terms of the rising cost of Medicare and Medicaid, I'd say that economists agree that is the most important area of the budget in terms of growth and something that is going to cause some problems for us. Social Security gets a lot more attention, but it's actually a much smaller problem. Medicare and Medicaid are growing at a very high rate, so eventually there's going to be some choice faced between raising taxes substantially or cutting benefits or doing something like means testing of those programs. Right? So, again, these are problems that will need to be faced in the future, or we will have some problems. My guess is that what's going to happen in the end is that taxes will go up, and the programs will be means tested, which has some problems, but we will get through it.
Professor Kaplan, talk about how your theory plays into or is illustrated by the recent comprehensive immigration reform debate.
Right, that's a very interesting one. So I mentioned this anti-foreign bias, where people tend to underestimate the gains of interacting with foreigners, and I think that holds very much for immigrants. So basically, trade with immigrants is like trade with other countries, except it's trade in labor. But when Americans hire immigrants, we're better off, they're better off, as is clear when, say, a woman who's got a PhD in computer science goes and hires a nanny to take care of her kids so she can go back to work. But nevertheless, there's a great deal of anger and fear felt towards immigrants, which I think went into the defeat of the amnesty. So a lot of people were very concerned, saying 12 million people are going to get an amnesty. And the most economists thinking, well, what's so bad about that? There are 12 million people here. Most of them are quite productive. They pull their own weight, and yet people want to get rid of them. Not so clear why. So, and then in terms of trying to keep further immigrants out and keep immigration down, again, there's a lot of gains in this to Americans that tend to be overlooked because the people involved are foreigners rather than people who were born here.
Yeah, maybe people didn't believe that argument that the immigrants, illegal immigrants, were doing jobs that Americans would not.
Right, right. Well, that's one of those arguments that economists know is false, and yet it's also one of the few that convinces anyone. So, just for background. So people will say immigrants do jobs that Americans won't do. Well, economists will say, well, won't do at what wage? Right. So, Americans would pick oranges if it paid mm-hmm. a lot more money. So it's not literally true that immigrants do jobs that Americans don't want to do. What you could say is that immigrants do jobs that Americans are better off not doing. Right? The immigrants do jobs where American skills will be better applied in some other area, and immigrants do jobs that, while Americans would do for sufficiently high wage, it would be a waste of skilled labor to do it, and it would be better to have less skilled labor doing it. Now, in terms of other issues involving immigrants, illegal immigrants are particularly interesting because while there's a lot of concern about them, using free services and so on, and being a fiscal burden on the government, the thing about illegal immigrants is they tend to be healthy young males, and our welfare state is basically designed to support the sick, the elderly, and women and kids. So actually, illegal immigrants are among the people who are least likely to be collecting benefits, and at the same time, precisely because they often will have, say, a fake Social Security card, they will be paying taxes they're never going to collect benefits on. So illegal immigrants, from a fiscal point of view, are actually a pretty good deal.
Yeah. So why do you think that the reform was defeated?
Well, I think it was defeated because it was unpopular. Right? Politicians realized that most Americans don't like the idea of giving amnesty to 12 million immigrants. And even though that would have been a good idea for us and for them, politicians saw that it was going to make them less popular, and so they didn't want to support it. Of course, some did, but it was not possible to get a majority because most politicians thought it was going to be worse for them. And, of course, this doesn't mean that the politicians who voted against were insincere. They're regular Americans, so probably the arguments that appeal to most Americans appeal to most politicians as well.
So because this was irrational?
Right. Again, what I would say is that opposition to the amnesty was based on some irrational beliefs. It is possible that someone could say, well, I understand everything that economics teaches about immigration, but I just hate immigrants. All right? And to that person, I'd say, well, I don't agree with your values, but in terms of, I'm not going to call you irrational because you understand what's going on. All right? What I would say is that the actual support that we have in large part, or the actual opposition to immigration that we had in large part, was based upon an irrational assessment of the costs and benefits of immigration.
Next, we go to Brian in Oshkosh. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing? I got a couple things to say. First of all, one comment is about the whole issue in terms of the illegal immigrants. It's xenophobia, clear and simple. There's no real lack of history in the United States about illegal immigrants. Secondly, I love to hear all the people who consider themselves to be conservative talking about the idea of saving money in the government. We're sitting right now on the largest deficit thanks to George Bush's administration, and it doesn't seem to make any difference. But what really is the point that I listen to public radio about a lot is that a real tremendous watershed came a number of years ago for me when I realized that Republicans, Democrats, as parties, as liberals, conservatives, whatever you might label them, are fairly irrelevant. What is relevant in the political structure today is the lobbyist element that dictates policy. In matter of fact, under the Bush administration, has written a bunch of policy, has worked particularly through Democrats hoping to achieve political office, and that's all I have to say. We're losing our democracy to the lobbyists. We're losing our democracy to computer sound bites. Thank you.
You don't agree with that, though, do you?
No, I do not. Interestingly enough, this is actually a view that a lot of economists share when they look at Washington and say special interests are running everything. One of the main things that I've been telling them is, well, let's take a look at something like farm subsidies. Economists tend to assume that the only people who want farm subsidies are farmers and everybody else is against them, and somehow farmers have rammed them down our throats. But if you actually take a look at public opinion, you'll see that about 80% of Americans favor farm subsidies, and those percentages are very similar in farm states and non-farm states. So really these policies that, of course, do have some lobbyists supporting them, nevertheless are quite popular, and there's no real reason to think that if the support fell from 80% to 40% that somehow the policy would continue to exist. in general, you know, if you are thinking that special interests are responsible for policy, it's a good idea to see, well, is the policy unpopular in the first place? Usually it'll turn out the policy is quite popular. Now, am I saying that lobbyists don't make any difference at all? No, I'm not saying that. Say, where lobbyists actually play a role is on the details. So if 80% of us can agree that farm subsidies are a good idea, we're going to have farm subsidies in a democracy. However, what the lobbyists may be able to do is to fine-tune the exact details of what those farm subsidies are like, what crops are going to get subsidized, how much are they. Basically, on all the issues that people say, oh, I don't know, whatever, those are the areas where where lobbyists or special interests show up and say, hey, well, we can all agree on this general principle, and now let those of us who actually know what's going on work out the details. And let's of course avoid making the details something that's completely offensive to the American people. But within some broad range, they're going to take what we give them, right? Again, this is really comes back to the public saying, look, you know, I want farm subsidies of some kind or other. If the public had a more specific view of farm subsidies in mind, then I'd say that democracy would give them that. But as long as they're pretty indifferent between a lot of different kinds of farm subsidies, that's where lobbyists have a chance to make a difference.
Yeah. So do you think lobbyists and special interests maybe made the Medicare D prescription drug benefit program different than what the public wanted?
Well, let's see. I'll say that I have not studied the many details of that extremely expensive program that extensively myself. I mean, certainly the general idea of having Medicare pay for prescription drugs was very popular. As to the exact form that it took, I certainly suspect that special interests had played a substantial role. As to whether they did something that most Americans think is bad, I don't think there's too much evidence of that. Again, I think this is something where once you have the general principle in place, most people pretty much take what they can get, yeah, or take what they get.
Our guest is Brian Kaplan. He's an associate professor of economics at George Mason University. He is author of the book, The Myth of the Rational Voter, Why Democracies Choose Bad Policies. He says that the greatest obstacle to sound economic policy is not special interests or lobbying, but the misconceptions, the irrational beliefs, and personal biases held by ordinary voters. 1-800-642-1234. What do you think? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along and hope you stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock, talking with a guest about Karl Rove stepping down yesterday as White House Deputy Chief of Staff. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. You're invited to join Kathleen Dunn, Gene Faraca, Ben Marins, and me for a special day at the Discovery World Museum in Milwaukee on Sunday, August the 26th. You'll be treated to a private after-hours tour of the museum, a wonderful buffet dinner at the museum. There's also, I think there's still room on the Lake Michigan cruise on the motor yacht Voyager. So that's a part of the package if you want it to be. And there'll be lots of time to talk to hosts and managers and fellow listeners. So I hope that you can join us for this very special event. Space is limited. Call today to make your reservation or to get more information about Wisconsin Public Radio's VIP gathering at Discovery World in Milwaukee on August 26th. Call Sandy at 414-227-2047, 414-227-2047. We are talking with Brian Kaplan, author of the book, The Myth of the Rational Voter, Why Democracies Choose Bad Policies. Professor Kaplan says that we have biases and misconceptions, especially about the economy, that lead us to make bad voting choices. We have an anti-market, anti-free market bias. We have an anti-foreign or foreigner bias, and others. Connie in Middleton is with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I find it difficult to accept the basic idea that the professor has, because he talks so much about economic policies and the rightness of things like free trade or immigration. but I don't feel I can really accept his ideas as long as economists think they know so much about these things, when I find that they're very uninformed about the environment, and they would make decisions about immigration or free trade that have would not be very wise in terms of what's actually happening to our planet and to the environment generally. I think an earlier caller mentioned something along those lines, too.
Yeah, so it's not just the economy, Brian Kaplan?
Well, of course, it is not just the economy. We've been focusing on that partly because I am an economist, partly because there is this long tradition in economics of complaining about the misconception of the public. Part of what I say in the book is I'm very interested in what experts in other fields have to say about how they think the misconceptions about their field are slanting public policy in a bad way. I am puzzled as to why one would say that economists have an especially bad understanding of what's going on with the environment. Economists have, while this isn't their specialty, there is a whole area of environmental economics that economists have been studying for quite a long time. In terms of what the environmental consequences or the bad environmental consequences of free trade and immigration are supposed to be, it's not so clear to me. In general, what I would say is that there's a strong tendency for countries that are richer to have cleaner environments, and also for environments to get cleaner as countries get richer. So the kinds of policies that do make countries richer are likely to make our environment cleaner in the end. So that's at least one place that I would start.
Talk about your theory and gas prices.
Right. So basically what's been going on in gas prices is, in particular, there's been a large increase in the demand for gasoline from China and from the growth of the Chinese and Indian economies, which you would naturally expect would substantially raise gas prices, especially over the short term. And yet, when people look at higher gas prices, there's a tendency to think there must be some kind of business conspiracy behind all of it, and to think there must be five guys in a back room smoking cigars who have decided that it's time for the price to go up. That's really quite unlikely. So people tend to look around for someone to blame when really the problem is just scarcity and supply and demand. I think this is especially clear after Katrina, when a whole bunch of refineries were shut down, and exactly what you would expect would happen, which is the price went up substantially, and yet people were looking around thinking that someone had actually plotted all of this rather than it just being an act of nature combined with the fact that the demand did not change very much. So, of course, price is going to go up.
Didn't we have disagreement, though, among the experts when there were record high profits from the oil companies? And a lot of people were wondering if there was some sort of price gouging going on.
Right. I would say among economists there was very, very little question about this. So, it is not so surprising there would be high profits under these conditions, because basically, given the fact that it's very hard to increase the amount of gasoline in the market very quickly, if there is a disaster, if there is a disaster, those who are able to keep the refineries going open are going to do very well. Just like, for example, if there is a sudden drought in most parts of the world, farmers who manage to keep their farms operating at capacity are going to see they're going to have high profits. It doesn't mean that there's a conspiracy. It just means that it's hard to grow a lot of crops suddenly in the winter if there's been an unexpected decline in the world supply of food.
Alex in Wauwatosa is with us now. Hi, Alex.
Hello. I agree very much with the idea that voters are incapable of determining, economic policy, but I would disagree very much that any panel of experts or group of economists or anybody, including the Fed, is capable of determining those policies. I mean, what we're talking about is central economic planning, which has never worked and never will work. The only way for an economy to operate properly and for supply and demand to be met is through liberty and freedom. And any central economic theory that's imposed by the coercive arm of the state is going to collapse, because it's, by definition, it's not able to acquire all the information. Like that computer programmer said, you cannot write a computer program that can gather all the information and spit out the data that's necessary to establish prices. That can only be done by individuals who are engaging in competitive you know, trade individually. And economic planning has never worked historically. It never will work.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a very interesting question because it sounds like you said quite a few economics classes.
Hold on, Alex.
I mean, what I would say there is that the interesting thing about what economists have to say about good economic policy is that economists don't generally say the best economic policy is to let economists centrally plan the economy. Usually what economists say is the best economic policy is to rely more on markets and not actually expect us to boss everybody around. So in fact, one of the main areas of consensus in economics is precisely that central economic planning is a bad idea, but it's popular, which is why you actually wind up often seeing it. So, I mean, I'm certainly not saying that it would be a good idea for economists to become the socialist planners of the country. I'm actually saying that if we were to listen to economists, we'd be doing less of that rather than more.
Here, here, yeah. Yeah, like that other caller said about the, you know, you got Republicans and Democrats just, you know, ramping up the spending and trying to plan, you know, make this economic planning. I mean, there is an individual who is against all that, who's attempting to restore liberty to our country, and his name is Ron Paul.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Republican, so I would suggest they look into his policies, just for that other caller.
I would say that out of all the candidates, Ron Paul is the least anti-market among them, so that's something strongly in his favor.
Mm-hmm. He is a libertarian, essentially, mm-hmm. isn't he?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, and so are you.
That certainly is my leaning. I haven't focused on that because I want to emphasize the areas where economists agree rather than the areas of controversy, but yes.
Kathy in Watertown, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, going back to an issue that he spoke about, people's biases set policies when they vote, or, you know, who they vote for comes out of their biases. One of the things that I find strange is that people that are pro-life and they say that they're pro-life and vote only for a candidate that it opposes abortion. It's kind of an oxymoron to me when then that same person goes out and kills millions of people. Well, they're not pro-life. They voted just for a single issue. And instead we end up with, you know, people being killed right and left all over the world and bad policies. So people have to think through what their issues are a little better and not be so single-motivated when they go to the polls. Yeah. That's just what I think.
All right. Well, do you have any, is that irrational, Professor Kaplan?
Right. Well, I don't focus on foreign policy in the book. Certainly, I think that there are some interesting patterns in public opinion about foreign policy that tend to lead us down the wrong road. One that's quite well established is what's called the rally around the flag effect. Basically, you can make a war popular by declaring a war. Very well established. So, you know, basically by declaring a war, you can suddenly make a war 20 or 30 percentage points more popular for a while. And if you think about the kinds of incentives this gives to politicians, it does mean that if you've got a war where public support is sort of leaning against it, you could just go ahead with it, and it's likely the public will back you up and change their mind just on the basis of that. Also kind of interesting, another pattern is that while just declaring war makes wars more popular, they also tend to decline in popularity over time, even if they're really going about as well as you should have expected from the beginning. So this means there's a tendency for democracies to, first of all, go into wars that are not such a good idea, and second of all, to go and pull out, even if you're at a point where that may be doing more harm than good.
Yeah, we have an open line if you would like to talk with Brian Kaplan, who is the author of The Myth of the Rational Voter, Why Democracies Choose Bad Policies, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. Professor Kaplan, I talked with the author of a book the other day. I think it was called Hunting with Jesus, and he was his point was is that a lot of people, especially low income people, were voting for Republican candidates when the policies promoted by the Republican candidates were not necessarily going to help them in the pocketbook, the voters, mm-hmm. that they were voting against their own economic self interest. Mm-hmm. Are you saying the opposite?
Let's see.
Low-income people are voting for Republican candidates who say don't want to raise the minimum wage or the various economic policies that maybe sent the manufacturing job overseas that this person might have had in their small town. Do low-income voters vote against their own economic self-interest?
Right. I would say yes in a lot of cases, but there's sort of two things going on. One of them is thinking, hey, that thing is in my economic self-interest, but I don't want it because there's something else more important to me. The other is actually being confused about where your own economic self-interest lies, and I think you have both going on. So in the case of the minimum wage, this is something where, again, this is not nearly as settled as something like free trade, but overall there's at least a substantial percentage of economists who think that the minimum wage is on net bad for people with low incomes because it makes it a lot harder to find a job, right? So in that case, someone might support the minimum wage contrary to their own self-interest because they don't realize that there's going to be these negative consequences for the chance that they're actually going to get a job in the first place. Now, on the other hand, you have something like support for less progressive taxation. This is something where it's quite likely the poor are actually worse off when the tax system is less progressive. But here's something where people may say, yeah, well, I realize that I would be better off if taxes on the rich were higher and taxes on the poor were lower, but I'm focused on something else. So maybe they're focused on religion, or maybe they're focused on what's good for the economy overall rather than what's good for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Bob in La Crosse, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment and see what your guest's response would be to it. And that is, I think sometimes the disconnect between the individual voter and economic theory is that so often economic theory takes the long-term trend approach, which is absolutely correct. But on the other hand, the individual voter is faced with a relatively short lifetime, and the 55-year-old voter who's being told that free trade is good, but, oh, by the way, you have to get a better education, too little too late for him. So I think it's because of those personal biases where the individual doesn't always fit into the trend that causes some of the disconnect.
Hmm. That's a very interesting hypothesis, and actually a lot of economists have shared it. So there's a famous economist, Joseph Schumpeter, whose story was the reason why economists and the public disagree is that we take the long-run view and the public takes a short-run view. Turns out that on the survey that I was working on, there was an interesting question that was directly related to this, where after asking a lot of questions about what are the effects of downsizing international trade and so on, there was one question that said, all right, how about 20 years from now? What will the effects be there? And it turned out that actually the gap between economists and the public was even larger on this long-run question, suggesting that it's not really a long-run versus short-run issue. Instead, it's a question of what are the effects of various policies and various occurrences at any particular time. And in fact, it seems the public underestimates, for example, the benefits of free trade not only in the short run but in the long run as well.
We'll leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Brian Kaplan, author of The Myth of the Rational Voter, Why Democracies Choose Bad Policies. Brian Kaplan, also an associate professor of economics at George Mason University. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour and to Leo Duran and Cheryl Gasser for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.